It's been quite a week. The World Health Organization has declared the coronavirus a pandemic. Trading on the stock market was halted briefly as Wall Street saw its biggest drop on Monday. And now economists are facing the reality of the R word. The Council of Revenues downgraded its state forecast, now projecting there may be $300 million that we can't count on in our tax coffers. Paul Brubaker of TZ Economics sat down with us earlier this week. Since the beginning of the year, he'd been warning the community to brace itself.
To me, it looks like something between SARS and 9/11. It could get as bad as one. It's probably at least as bad as the first. The big difference, of course, is that nobody in Hawaii had SARS, so it was contained quickly. Whereas this time, containment has not succeeded, notwithstanding similar zoonotic origins. And so here we are.
I heard that someone say that we're beyond containment. You know, cat's out of the bag.
We're somewhere between containment and mitigation. Yeah, I agree.
So we've been seeing the stories about the cruise ship business. We've seen stories about how bookings are down at the hotels. I don't know, maybe up to 30%. What's your feel as to? I mean, are we in a recession or not?
Yeah, Hawaii's probably at risk of recession. I'm not sure we're in one. I'm not sure anybody actually knows that tourism last year already was in recession. That is, real tourism receipts in 2019 declined. They didn't increase, they decreased. Why the state doesn't want to talk about that, I don't know. But if it's one of these things, if the state doesn't make it official by announcing it, then it never becomes part of the discussion. And it seems to have been what the plan was with the coronavirus. So if we don't test for it, then we won't know if there is any. And we can say that there isn't. And nobody can dispute it. Seems like a really odd way of going about engaging people in collective action and, you know, designing public policy. But to your question, if tourism was already slipping last year and other economic indicators, exhibited a degree of impairment that you didn't see in the rest of the U.S., then if we're not in recession, we were already at the brink of it, and this definitely could push us down into it.
When we talk about the coronavirus and we see where things have gone with the rest of these countries and how fast it's moved, it is surprising. Some countries are doing so many tests a day. And, you know, we did have the gift of time, but did we use that time wisely?
My impression is that the lack of testing until March 4th, 2020, we should remember there was an actual date that the state conducted its first test. That month was a precious one, and that the reason containment is less likely now is that the testing never occurred, so we weren't aware of its presence. We can't even assert that it was present, but this seems a lot of suspicion that it must have been, or at least might have been. I mean, we started with the Japanese couple in late January, early February. They got back to Tokyo on February 6th and went straight into the hospital, the husband did. And they were on Maui and Oahu. And now we're hearing people having returned from Asia, found themselves sick but were unable to have been tested under the protocols. So to be fair to the state, they were following guidelines that in retrospect just seem idiotic. And, I mean, to the point where you would say, why would I follow that guideline? I mean, you know, they're testing 100, they tested 140,000 people in Korea or something as of last week. What the hell? We tested 19 as of today in Hawaii, and we missed a moment there. Testing allows you to identify whether a problem exists and where it exists. If it exists, if you know where it exists, then you can start to work on the containment part of it. If you know who has it, then you can think about who those persons may have come into contact with and, you know, design your response accordingly.
And
but
we've seen
went for a month without knowing any of that.
We've seen cases also in Washington State and California, and those are two areas where we get a lot of domestic visitors. You know, Japan, obviously, the biggie. But that's got to make some people nervous in the tourism business.
There's two issues, right? There's, are you going to get sick if you're on the plane or on the cruise ship? That's one issue. And then there's a second issue, which is, are you going to get sick in the place that you're traveling to? Are you going to get sick in the destination? What differs from SARS in this case of the novel coronavirus is that concern about getting on a plane existed, but nobody was going to get SARS when they got to Hawaii. And the problem right now is that we have confirmed cases, but what's even more obvious because of the uncertainty created by not having tests available is that there could be more exposure already. And that uncertainty alone is what, you know, makes people crazy. And so they, you know, they're people are risk averse and they choose to defer their travel to Hawaii. They can wait till the time when probability of becoming affected is declining. And that's what they're doing now. They're choosing to cancel trips already planned and deferring trips or gatherings that they had in mind but have now decided are imprudent.
We have seen the situation with the cruise industry. What's your take on that?
Well, it's unfortunate that cruise ships provide a natural environment for rapid spread among large numbers of people of infectious disease. And when they're, you know, crossing the ocean to get to Hawaii, they also provide an incubation period. So they've had bad luck, that part of the industry. The same thing in principle could happen in airplanes or in hotels and any place that people are gathered in large numbers in close quarters. This is, you know, and the reason why urban environments are so contagious. So I think a bit of it is bad luck, and it might be an overreaction to, you know, say don't come here for a while, but it could be the prudent thing to do at the state we're in now, having seen a failure at containment and having us begin to shift gears towards mitigation.
Right. We saw what happened in Japan. We're watching what's happening in Oakland, California. I think there's another cruise ship off the Caribbean that's kind of on hold.
It seems like we're learning from these experiences. So the first thing we learned is don't leave everybody on board. because that's what happened in Japan. And then if you leave everybody on board, then it just keeps spreading. But then it's a tricky thing to remove 2,500 passengers and 1,000 crew and, you know, move them to a quarantine where each of them essentially has to be isolated, or at least small groups, couples maybe. In the case of the Grand Princess now in Oakland, I believe the crew is going to stay aboard. Wow, that sounds like that's a scary thing right there for them. But it seems as if we're learning by doing in all these cases.
Well, I know the Lieutenant Governor did call on the White House to basically ban cruise ships for 60 days here. Vice President Pence kind of stopped short of doing something draconian, but did say, hey, if you have any underlying health issues, maybe don't risk it.
It's a little tricky to have an industry cease and desist. I mean, we have constitutional protections for interstate commerce, for example, that have to be kept in mind. And there's jurisdictional issues, right? You know, you're the LG of Hawaii, but you're not the LG of any state on the U.S. mainland. So I'm glad they've engaged in a discussion with the federal government, because it really is a federal decision.
Well, we are at the start of what would be, I guess, peak cruising season.
Without prevention, without vaccination available, and sounds like that's going to be a year or more, you have to either prevent the virus from spreading at all, which is the containment part, or, you know, deal with it once it's there, and we're right there in the middle. We're fortunate that at the moment, I think we'll know more about this in a week or so, because the testing is now becoming possible in Hawaii. But at the moment, we really don't know how extensive exposure is. There's a certain reassurance that comes from what we're learning, which is that younger people don't seem to be as badly affected, and mortality is seems concentrated primarily in the elderly, for which added precautions and protections are going to have to be concocted. So there's that sort of reassurance that things like asymptomatic experiences are probably more widespread than we can enumerate at the present time. Still, you know, there's a risk here, and people are responding to it. And so the economic consequences of what we're seeing are a product of people's rational decision-making in the face of uncertainty and risk. And unfortunately for Hawaii, and that's why I mentioned earlier, we've seen this before, anytime uncertainty is this extensive and potentially catastrophic, you know, it's easy to decide not to get on an airplane and go to Hawaii. So that's where we're at right now. We're seeing the numbers drop very quickly. I'm going to guess right now that we're going to have a really hard period for a couple months. It's going to be a tough end of the winter and a tough climb out, I imagine, in the spring. And then the big question mark for tourism and therefore for the economy in Hawaii as a whole is whether we can, you know, stabilize and recover by the summertime. Summer's a big season. So, you know, if we forego summer in 2020, it'll be a lot harder than if things come back, let's say, by May.
Point of view, do you think the lawmakers are going to have to mark up their plan this session? I mean, with minimum wage and all these ambitious things that they announced that they were going to do at the beginning of session.
You know, I've heard from some of legislative leadership that they are having to pivot because of the nature of circumstances. In terms of policy recommendations, I mean, besides the obvious constraint that revenue growth almost certainly will not be what people had in mind at the outset of this legislative session, but, you know, that doesn't mean many of those items on this new agenda that people seem to be gravitating toward couldn't be pursued down the road. But we have to switch, obviously. We have to pivot to, you know, short-term immediate concerns, which are going to involve employment, the adequacy of the unemployment insurance fund. You know, how are you going to back that up if the fund proves not to be adequate? What would the plan for that be? And then, you know, there are different ways of, if the point is to help the economy in the longer term, then some of the what was in the plan before makes sense. But if you have to do things in the short run, then maybe the help comes in different forms.
Right.
So, for example, you hear people talking about fiscal stimulus. Well, we're not talking about building bridges or, you know, infrastructure investment. We're talking about, you know, financing the health response, right? Making sure people can get treatment. Maybe even, I mean, if this is an identifiable disease that's, you know, different from everything else, maybe that's where the money needs to go in the short term. And there are populations, you know, like the homeless population, obviously the elderly, and, you know, persons in lower income quantiles, those households tend to be at higher risk because, you know, lower incomes leads to poorer nutrition and you know, a host of other, you know, structural contributors to vulnerability that don't exist in more wealthy households. So those are, you know, I would imagine those are the kinds of things that people will have to start talking about very quickly here.
That was economist Paul Brubaker of TZ Economics talking about the impacts of COVID-19 pandemic.